This episode is sponsored by Indeed. There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes of this show, booking guests across time zones, tight turnaround edits, and constant time management. And when things get chaotic, you realize pretty quickly how important it is to have the right person on your team. If I had to hire someone tomorrow, I wouldn't just want a good editor. I'd want someone who understands pace in long-form interviews and can work fast under pressure. And in moments like that, you think, this is a job for sponsored jobs. Because Indeed sponsored jobs boost your listing in search results, helping you reach the candidates with the specific skills and experience you actually need. And it works. Sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed are 95% more likely to report a hire than non-sponsored jobs. That's a serious edge when the pressure's on. Spend less time searching and more time actually interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. When you need the right person to cut through the chaos, this is a job for Indeed sponsored jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? This is a job for Indeed sponsored jobs. Cadillac has entered Formula One, deepening the racing pedigree behind every V-Series on the road. Discover a lineup that delivers pure adrenaline in the form of modern luxury. Experience the quickest Cadillac ever, the all-electric Lyriq V, the peak performance of the CT5V Blackwing, the nimble agility of the Optiq V, and the legendary roar of the Escalade V, all engineered to thrill. Find out more about Cadillac's performance story in Formula One and our race-tested V-Series lineup at Cadillac.com.
Spring into deals at Lowe's. Shop select 1.5-gallon annuals hanging baskets, 2 for $15, for the perfect addition to Mom's garden. Plus, get 3 free bags of Miracle-Gro 0.75 cubic foot garden soil when you buy 3. Our best lineup is here at Lowe's. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 5/6, excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on Silver Drive in Columbus.
I started this journey when I was 5. And I always believed I could be in Formula One. As I got closer to the race, I felt like I was getting more calm instead of more nervous.
Our journey around the world to crown a champion is about to begin.
The grandstands are completely packed. Everything's so exciting. So remember sitting on the grid before the race, just like really feeling the moment, you know? My coach Ollie was there and he said to me just before I was getting in, all the years of hard work were for this. And that hit me really deep. I remember in the moment, I almost immediately like shed a tear.
Cars forming into position. When the last car is in place, it will be time to look to the lights.
I had to sort of calm myself down because, you know, I had a race to do.
The new season is underway. And what an absolutely superb getaway for Arvid Vindblad, who's into form.
On that day in Australia, aged 18, Arvid Lindblad, the fourth youngest Grand Prix driver in history, showed he belongs on track with the very best.
Every category I've done, I've always sort of been pushed as early as I could. I've always been the youngest guy on the block, the new kid, the underdog, you could say. So I'm kind of used to being in that situation, which also helped me, you know, to not be intimidated.
In his first race, Arvid duelled wheel-to-wheel with Lando Norris and Lewis Hamilton. He finished in the points. On just his third F1 weekend, he outqualified Max Verstappen. In his words, Arvid Lindblad is getting stuck in. Hello everyone, Tom Clarkson here. I loved speaking to Arvid for this episode of F1 Beyond the Grid. The seed of his F1 dream was sown when he watched a Grand Prix on TV at the age of 4, and he asked his dad,
could I ever be there one day? Like, how does this work? Like, is it possible?
His family, his coach, racing driver Oliver Rowland, and Red Bull's former motorsport advisor Helmut Marko helped him get there. and you can really tell how much Arvid's enjoying living his life's ambition. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm great, thank you. Enjoying the break. How has the break been for you?
Yeah, it's been good. I've tried to obviously have a bit of downtime, a bit of switch off. It's been quite a busy start to the year. Obviously, it started quite early with 3 tests already starting in January. So it's been quite intense. I mean, the last time I went home before this break was like middle end of January. So it's been nice just to sleep in my own bed again. But yeah, trying to have a bit of switch off, but also at the same time, staying fit, also, you know, working with the team, utilizing the time to be on the sim, trying to maximize the learning from the first couple of events to be as prepared as possible for Miami.
So a bit of training as well. How is the training? How much have you upped the training since Formula 2?
A bit more, but not massively more. I think people maybe underestimate how physical the F2 cars are as well. It's different, you know, what you have to, the physical demands between F2 and F1, because F2 as a car itself, I'd say, is actually more physical, because it's much more simple. So there's no power steering, the brake's much heavier.
The pressure on the brake pedal.
Yeah, you have to really slam it. But the biggest thing is just the power steering, like there's none. So it's really heavy. When the high speed corners, yeah, it's a lot of effort. It's sometimes to the point where you almost lose a bit of feeling because you're just, so it's like just brute force just trying to make it turn.
Can I ask you more about that? So let's imagine cops at Silverstone, very quick corner, whatever car you're in. Are you almost having to sort of wedge an elbow against the side of the cockpit in F2?
Not so much because of the shape of the corner. But where would I say it was quite bad?
Turn 3 Barcelona. Is that bad?
I'd say more like Qatar. Was it 12, 13, 14? You can't really wedge your arm in because you're always unwinding, but it's kind of just you turn. And I remember to a point where one lap in quali, I knew the car could do it. So I went in a bit quicker. And I just got to a point where I just couldn't physically turn the wheel anymore. So it's like you kind of go and you try to like almost wedge your arm in. You almost have to sometimes move your hand up to almost try to like force it down. But yeah, it's a bit nuts.
So with power steering in Formula One, how much easier is the steering?
Oh yeah, it's a different level. I mean, you just blow on the wheel and it turns. Like, I mean, coming from F2, it's easy. I mean, F2, it was in quali for like one lap, it was really hard. Then in the race, it wasn't as extreme as that. And it was only like that for, you know, one or two tracks. But yeah, there were times when it was, especially also if the balance wasn't very nice, it was a bit on the nose, then you always tense a bit more. It was quite physically draining. But then obviously F1, as everyone knows, the neck is a big thing just because the cars are faster, there's more downforce. So the neck's the main thing. But then also the races are longer, so you need to be more just physically fit. So there's more cardio that comes with that. So it's different training.
What's your cardio go-to, is it? Are you a
runner?
I'd
say running, yeah. Running's sort of what I like. I used to do quite a lot of swimming when I was younger, but then I kind of went off that a little bit. But yeah, now I love to run. I think what's so nice about it is because we get to go to all these, you know, crazy, amazing places in the world, you can just take a pair of trainers with you and you can go, you know, you can just go almost sightseeing whilst you're running, you know? So I went, when we were in Japan, I went running around Tokyo. I did like a 12K loop, you know, in the city and stuff. And you get to see it all. It's quite cool. They did the same in Melbourne. I don't know. I enjoy running. I think it's good for the mind, but also just because of the nature of what we do, it's also quite fun on the road.
And your trainer, your physio, Sam Village, he is a runner. I've come across him in the past.
Yes.
I guess he was always going to turn you into a runner, even if you weren't, right?
Yeah, I mean, I liked running, but to be fair, maybe you'd say that Sam was kind of the transition from when I really started to get more into it. But yeah, talk about Sam. He's a big runner himself. I think he did the Ironman like 10 years ago. He's doing the marathon again here in London. Yeah, he loves running. He's obviously, he's quite busy now. It's not easy, but there's a lot of times on Saturday morning or, you know, on a Friday night whenever we get a bit of time, he's trying to do laps around the track or laps around the city.
Do you run the track?
I do sometimes. Yeah. I wouldn't say it's like a routine thing that I do every week. But there has been quite a few events, especially last year, where I wanted to sort of clear my head or, you know, I wanted to sometimes see the track. Because you do a track walk, but I don't know, I just kind of wanted to see it again, where I go for a bit of a run on a Thursday night or something like that.
This episode is brought to you by Bitdefender, exclusive cybersecurity partner of Ferrari. In cybersecurity and Formula One, every millisecond counts. Only the most advanced cars and dedicated teamwork win races on the track And only the most advanced security technology and elite specialists have the power to prevent, defend, and stop cyber attacks. Technology makes all the difference in who has a clear advantage, where Bitdefender is renowned for driving leading-edge innovation in cybersecurity. Bitdefender helps safeguard the data of Ferrari. They supercharge the cybersecurity team's ability to swiftly identify and respond to any threat that arises. Bitdefender has earned the trust of Ferrari for its commitment to innovation and for being at the forefront of cybersecurity to manage continuous and evolving challenges. Join the millions of consumers and businesses that trust Bitdefender to protect their digital worlds. Visit bitdefender.com to learn more about how Bitdefender supports Ferrari to stay ahead of cyber threats and how you can make your digital life safer. This episode is sponsored by Indeed. There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes of this show, booking guests across time zones, tight turnaround edits, and constant time management. And when things get chaotic, you realize pretty quickly how important it is to have the right person on your team. If I had to hire someone tomorrow, I wouldn't just want a good editor. I'd want someone who understands pace in long-form interviews and can work fast under pressure. And in moments like that, you think, this is a job for sponsored jobs. Because Indeed sponsored jobs boost your listing in search results, helping you reach the candidates with the specific skills and experience you actually need. And it works. Sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed are 95% more likely to report a hire than non-sponsored jobs. That's a serious edge when the pressure's on. Spend less time searching and more time actually interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. When you need the right person to cut through the chaos, this is a job for Indeed sponsored jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? This is a job for Indeed sponsored jobs.
Hamilton's got a good launch on that corner, about to go wheel to wheel. Are we about to go three wide? Lindblad finds himself getting through. Lindblad to third, Hamilton to fourth, and Hadjar down to fifth.
Unbelievable, Arvid Lindblad.
Well, if anyone doesn't know his name, they do now.
Arvid Lindblad scores points as an 18-year-old on debut.
It's Alan. Well done, mate. Points on your debut. Incredible stuff. A near perfect weekend. Very proud of you, mate.
Can we just do a very brief resume of what's been a phenomenal start for you in Formula One? Wind the clock back to the beginning of March. When I say Melbourne to you, what springs to mind?
The first thing that happens when is I get like a little bit butterflies already and goosebumps just thinking about it. I mean, it was an amazing weekend.
What was the highlight?
I think just a lot of emotion comes. That's sort of the first thing that really comes to me, just because obviously the weekend went very well, but also the meaning behind the weekend. You know, it was my first race in Formula One. This is something I've been working towards and dreaming of my whole life. So just to have my debut was very exciting. I had my parents there with me as well, which was really cool. And then obviously the way the weekend went as well, it was, you know, Q3, then, you know, finishing in the points, but even, you know, running P3 at one point on lap one. It was just a pretty magical weekend. Yeah, I couldn't have even dreamt of it.
Tell us about that opening lap on the race. As you say, you were up to P3. Just what was it like from inside the cockpit? Because you look so assured from the outside. Did it feel all calm inside?
Yeah, I don't know. It was weird because I remember, like, I'd say from half an hour, 45 minutes before the race, all the way till sort of the lights going out. Like at 45 minutes before, I was pretty nervous, as you would expect. But almost as I got closer to the race, I felt like I was getting more calm instead of more nervous. And I remember very well, you know, sitting on the grid, obviously the grid in F1 is completely different to an F2. In F2, there's basically no grid procedure. We never get out of the cars. But in F1, you know, the grandstands are completely packed. The music, the vibe, everything's so exciting. So I remember sitting on the grid before the race, just like really feeling the moment, you know. It was pretty surreal for me even just to be there. So I was just kind of taking it all in, and it was quite a pinch me moment just before the race, sort of appreciating what was about to happen.
And what did you do when you got out of the car? Because the first time in your career that you have left the car on the grid, what did you do?
I think my trainer, Sam, Sammy came and picked me up, because obviously I was a bit confused. I mean, it is quite new. So he kind of picked me up. He's like, right, okay. When we discussed it before the race, because it was new, we discussed it before how it was going to work. But he picked me up. We went to the garage, went to the bathroom, had a bit of a sit down, a bit of a chill out. But you don't obviously have long. You're about 5 minutes before you have to go back for the national anthem. I remember that quite well. When I arrived at the national anthem, obviously you have your name card for where to stand. And it said my name, and obviously above it was the F1 logo. It said, you know, Formula One World Championship, and then Arvid Lindblad. And even just seeing that, you know, I got a bit emotional, just sort of appreciating what was about to happen. And then I said, yeah, when I got back to the car, I was really chill. And then I was starting just to get ready. And my coach, Ollie, was there. And he said to me just before I was getting in, all the years of hard work were for this. And that hit me really deep. I mean, I remember in the moment, I almost immediately like shed a tear. I had to sort of calm myself down because, you know, I had a race to do. I don't know, it really hit me, that sort of thing, you know, because it's, I don't know, maybe it's hard to relate to, maybe it's not, I don't know. But I mean, I started this journey when I was 5, and I always believed I could be in Formula One, and it's something I've always been working towards. It's always been at the forefront of my mind, and just the fact that it was coming true and it was really happening was incredibly exciting. And then obviously, yeah, sort of, I'm in the car, the formation lap starts, just focused on obviously trying to manage the procedures. It's all quite new with these new cars with the battery. Luckily, I did that quite well. I remember coming around the last corner just before coming into my grid box and feeling super calm. Like, I could see all the people in the grandstand. I could see that it was completely packed. But I don't know why, I almost got these flashbacks, almost this vision of when I was 6, 7, racing here in the UK at a track called Hooton. Well, it was just me and my dad, because it's quite, the shape of the last corner was quite similar. And I don't know, I just had got that sort of picture in front of me, and it really calmed me down in the moment. Like, I knew it was my first Formula One race and how busy it was, but it felt to me just like a karting race from 10 years ago, and it was just me and my dad. So I remember I parked in the grid box feeling really cool, lights start coming on, I'm just sort of trying to focus on nailing my procedure, which I did okay. And then, as soon as the lights went out, I was just went for every gap I could find and just kind of got stuck in, and was sort of slotting in between Lando and Lewis. And before I knew it, I was in P4.
Lando and Lewis. What you just said? It was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it is pretty crazy to talk about. I mean, obviously, they're both world champions. I think for me, I mean, obviously, later on in the lap, I passed Isaac, and then it was me, Isaac and Lewis, you know, really racing. And racing side by side with Lewis is pretty nuts. I mean, Lewis was a big reason for why I fell in love with the sport. You know, he was, I wouldn't say an idol, but he was the one I sort of looked up to, you know. It was just nuts, you know, to be able to race side by side with him, someone that I'd watched on the TV for years, you know, winning all those world championships. So it was pretty cool to think about, even like to the point where I remember I was doing it, but it only like hit me about 20 seconds later. I was like, oh my God, I've just like, I'm in P3, I've just been racing with Lewis. Like, wow, like this is insane.
My memories of that lap were that you were fearless. And actually, we talk about Lewis. It reminded me of Lewis's opening lap in Formula One, Melbourne, 2007. You hadn't even been born at this point, but, you know, he was fearless. He went round the outside of Fernando Alonso, his McLaren teammate at the time. And just seeing you go for those gaps and not be intimidated by the champions that were around you was an extraordinary thing. What were your expectations going into Melbourne? Because at least it looked like winter testing had gone well. I remember last day in Bahrain, you had the highest lap count of anybody, I think. You know, did you feel ready?
I think so. I mean, it's always hard to know in the end before it really happens. You know, you do all the preparation, do all the work, you do everything you can, you know, so you feel like you're ready, but you can never say with confidence, you never know, you know, until you're in qualifying, until you're in the race and it's really happening. So I think on that side, I felt as ready as I could be. Because of that, I really tried to go into the weekend, which to be honest, I've done all the first weekends without really any expectations and just focused on myself because, you know, these cars are so new, we're all learning, that I didn't really want to start the season by comparing myself to others or whatnot because I know there's so many boxes I need to tick just in myself because there's so many new things that are happening. So to answer your question on expectations, there weren't really any. And the goals I had coming into the weekend were very focused on myself, doing the basics well, nailing the procedures and just, yeah, getting, I mean, it was some, one of them also was, you know, being, I wouldn't say being fearless, but, you know, getting stuck in, you know, and I'd say on that side, I'm quite lucky because every category I've done, I've always sort of been pushed as early as I could. I've always been the youngest guy on the block, you know, the new kid, the underdog, you could say. So I'm kind of used to being in that situation, which also helped me, you know, to not be intimidated.
And you were able to keep your emotions under control as well.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I'm not a particularly emotional person when I'm in the car. I go into a bit of a different zone where I'm just very much focused on the driving and very in the moment. And just reacting to what's happening to me. So, yeah, there wasn't really much emotion, no.
You finish eighth, Britain's youngest ever point scorer in the history of Formula One. Can we talk about celebrations? Did it go on all night or what happened on Sunday night?
No, I mean, I enjoyed the evening. Like I said, I was there with my family, with my coach, with Sam. Even my coach brought his family as well. So it was, we were all together. It was really, that also adds to, you know, making the weekend feel a bit more special. It wasn't just, you know, it really felt like the whole team, you know, from the beginning. Because, you know, I've been working with Ollie, my coach, since I was 7.
Oh, we should just clarify. This is Oliver Rowland, isn't it?
Yes.
Reigning Formula E world champion. So he knows his eggs, right? He knows how to drive a car.
He knows what he's doing, yeah. He's pretty handy behind the wheel.
What does he actually do for you as your trainer, as you describe him?
I mean, it's a bit of everything. It's sort of more of a mentor, a guide, a coach sort of role. I mean, he does a bit of everything. You know, we talk about driving, we talk about mentality to go into the weekend, how to handle different situations, even, you know, with the media, you know, how to approach that to make sure it takes away as little energy out of me as possible. So it's a bit of everything, you know. He's a driver himself. He's done it all. So he's just giving me a bit of guidance, a bit of help on sort of all the different aspects of being a driver.
I wonder if it's something similar to what Oscar Piastri has this year. He's slightly changed the entourage around him. He has his old Prema engineer, Pedro Matos, coming to all the races with him now, just as another set of eyes and ears, really. You know, look at the data with him or make any sort of recommendations, if that's the right word. Is that what Oliver's doing for you?
Yeah, I would say similar, probably a bit more involved though. I know Pedro because when I was in Prema, and he's a really cool guy, but obviously, you know, Oscar and Pedro have a great relationship and that's why he's able to help him. But I've known Ollie since I was 7. Ollie's a driver himself, so I'd almost say our relationship and bond is probably a bit stronger just because he's known me for longer and he can really relate to me closer because he's done it all himself. You know, he's still driving now. It wasn't that long ago when he was on the ladder to F1.
It's almost like a sibling.
I would say he's like more like a second dad. I don't know. I'd say growing up he was like a second dad. Maybe now he's like more like an older brother. I don't know. But yeah, it kind of goes between the two.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes he's my mate and then he's my older brother. And then when he's a bit more, you know, angry, then maybe he's like a second dad.
You know, you said you didn't have expectations at any of the opening three races. Did your approach change going into China just a week after Melbourne, having had all that success, having proved that you deserved to be there and that you could do it in Formula One?
No. No, I wouldn't say so. I would say I had a bit more confidence in myself just because I had, you know, I'd showed what I could do. Maybe I had a little bit more belief, but honestly, on an approach point of view, from a mentality side, I approached it the same. I knew China was going to be a really difficult challenge. It was a new track for me. It's my first sprint weekend. So it was going to be a tall order to be able to perform and do things right. So no, I wouldn't say things really were any different.
Being a sprint weekend though, it kind of, the format is almost more like Formula 2, isn't it?
It is closer to Formula 2, yeah. I mean, I was talking about it with Ollie and Sam before the race that it's... Yeah, a bit like what I'm used to from the last couple of years, you know, because F2 and F3 are the same. They're very similar. So, yeah, that helped out a little bit, you could say.
Fast forward to 2 weeks later, we're now in Japan. Again, the approach is the same, right?
Yep.
But what about Suzuka? Can I just ask you about the track? How many times have you played it on the F1 game? You know, what was it like to drive such an iconic circuit?
It was amazing. It was probably the race I was most looking forward to this year. It was my first time there. Obviously, the Junior Series don't get to go. And it was unbelievable. I mean, I think there's not that many tracks now that are such high speed, so punishing if you make a mistake. And because of both of those parts, something that I almost felt was that because everything's happening so quickly and you're so in the zone, you can't think. Everything's almost subconscious. And it's rare that you do think, but there are, you know, laps that are a bit more, that aren't quite as intense. But because it was so subconscious and just so much on feeling, so pure, that it almost reminded me of my early karting days, you know, when you're just driving, you're not thinking, you're just sending it, you know, you're just having fun, you're just really, just you and the kart and just going. So that for me was really enjoyable. It was almost taking me back to the early days. So that for me was the thing I almost enjoyed the most about the track. But then obviously going into the circuit itself, it's amazing. It's such high speed, you need a lot of commitment, and it's such a iconic circuit as well. So it was just really enjoyable to drive.
Did I read that you were a Senna fan? You are a Senna fan, Ayrton Senna?
Not really.
Okay. Where did I read that?
I would say I have a massive respect for Ayrton, and you know, obviously what he's done in the sport is unbelievable. The only reason why I say I wouldn't say I'm a Senna fan, or maybe I don't idolize Ayrton, is just because his time was so much before mine, and I don't feel like I really know that much about him. I mean, obviously there's some stories and there's stuff, but I mean, growing up seeing Lewis, you know, I was watching him on the TV, I could see everything, I could watch his onboards, you know, I could watch his overtakes, all that sort of stuff. Whereas with Ayrton, the sort of footage available, the stories available are so much smaller that for me it was just, I couldn't get enough of a grasp, you know, and an understanding of him. So that was why.
The only reason I ask about him is I find whenever I'm at Suzuka, it's the one place that I feel the bond between Senna and now is strongest, because the track hasn't changed. And there is some amazing footage on YouTube of Senna driving, I think it's an NSX, in his civvies, and he's got,
yeah,
you watch him stabbing at the throttle and heel and toeing, which I guess you haven't had to do in your career. But it's a great bit of footage. But look, final thing on Suzuka is that quali lap. Everyone in the team said it was a giant of a lap, and it put Max Verstappen out. That's the one I'm referring to. You know, it put Max Verstappen out in Q2. How good was the lap, and what did it feel like to take that scalp, if that's the right expression?
Yeah, it was pretty nuts. It was cool. I mean, going almost a bit sort of back, it wasn't an easy weekend. FP1 went okay, but then I missed all of FP2 with an issue. I'd missed a good chunk of FP3. So I was coming into quali a little bit lost and not really sure what to expect. Like I said before, Suzuka is such a high-speed track, so you need a lot of commitment, which means you need confidence. You need laps to build that confidence. And coming there as a rookie, that was kind of the one thing I needed. Because if you're more experienced and, you know, you've done it a lot of times, maybe if you miss a few laps on the weekend, you can kind of figure it out. But I mean, it was my first time there, and having such an interrupted week leading up to quali was not easy. So I really just tried to make the best of the situation and learn during, especially Q1. The team did a really good job to give me a car that I had confidence in, that I could build with. And then I know I remember coming in after that first run of Q2, looking on the timesheet, seeing I was about 0.4 off the cutoff. And I thought to myself, it's going to be a bit difficult to get through here. I'm going to need to, I don't really know if it's on the cards. So I told myself, right, I've got nothing to lose. This potentially, it's probably going to be my last lap of, you know, this qualifying, the last lap on low fuel. I'm just going to send it and just go have some fun, you know, and just leave everything on the track and just have no regrets. Because that was something I was a little bit sad about from Melbourne and China. Even though Melbourne went so well, you know, with Q3, because of, you know, we had a few issues during the qualifying and all this kind of stuff. And same in China with the yellow flag coming out. I didn't feel like I got that one lap where I could just switch off my brain and just go, you know, and just not really think and just leave everything out there. So, you know, I told myself it's probably going to be my last chance. You know, this is my lap to do that. That was the approach I went in with, and I just sent it and hoped for the best. And it was pretty cool. I mean, it was a pretty good lap. I didn't make any mistakes. I sort of hooked it up well. And
where did you find that 4 tenths?
It was a bit everywhere.
Right.
I mean, there was a good chunk in sector one. It was probably 2 tenths in sector one. But then, you know, there was a bit in the hairpin in 11, a bit more in 13, 14, just because they committed a bit more in 13, but then still got the line nice for 14, which is not easy there because, you know, it's a double apex, the tyres overheat, so all this kind of stuff. Just got that spot on. I was really efficient as well with the approach I had. So I had lots of energy for the straight. So I gained a little bit more on the straight, even though I was quicker in the corner as well. I mean, I remember coming into the last chicane, and I think at this point I was half a second up on the dash because I was 4 tenths off the cutoff at the time, but obviously that improved. So I'm like half a second, I think 5.5 tenths up on the dash. I remember even screamed in the helmet because I was just like, you know, come on, like, don't mess it up kind of thing. That was all us into the last chicane. I was like, all right, just don't mess it up, just nail it. But then, yeah, I don't know, I just broke late, got the curb nexely, and Delta went up to like 6.5 tenths. And then I crossed the line. I remember, I think the first thing I opened the radio with was like, mate, come on, that's got to be enough. Like, please tell me that's enough, you know? And yeah, like 20 seconds later, I was like, you know, congratulations, you're in Q3. And it's just like, wow.
Come on, mate, that's got to be a good one.
That was a good lap. I keep you posted. Sorry. We're still waiting for one more stop.
He does it!
Yeah.
The rookie driver, 18 years of age, Arvid Lindblad, knocks out the four-time champ. An almighty shock at a circuit Verstappen has made his own.
You're such an instinctive driver. We've learned that about you already. What did Max say? Did he come up to you afterwards or any conversation with him?
No, we haven't really spoken about it. I mean, obviously for him, it was not a particularly nice day. He hasn't had the most fun so far this year. But I mean, for me, to be honest, I don't really care who it is that I you know, knock out or beat. In the end, I was just so happy to be in Q3 after all the difficulties that I'd had so far that weekend, to really just pull it together with my guys, you know, on my side of the garage. It was just a very special moment. So yeah, it doesn't really matter the person. It was just be able to start in the top 10.
You know, you said the team gave you a really good car. I guess every racing driver wants a neutral car, but what is your preferred car? I mean, do you like a car that's right on the nose, or just what is a really good car that you really feel you can get a hold of and do your thing?
I don't know. I would say I'm probably more on the oversteer than the understeer side. I don't really like understeer. I just think it's slow. In the end, I mean, we need to go around the corner as fast as possible. So if the car turns quicker, you go around the corner a bit quicker. So, I mean, obviously there's to a point where then you're limited by the rear, but if you can just turn quicker, then you go quicker. So, I don't know. I would say I like a car that is relatively neutral. But if I had to choose one, I'd say a bit more on the nose than on the understeer side.
Something Alan Permain said recently was that you can be a bit harsh on yourself. Can you see that character trait in you? Are you a perfectionist?
Maybe a little bit. I like to do things properly. But at the same time, I don't know, I try to get the balance right. But in the end, you don't learn anything by not being honest to yourself and, you know, accepting when you haven't done things well and when things can be done better. So I try to get the balance right and cut myself some flack when it's needed. But in the end, I think the point I am in my career at the moment, there's a lot to learn. And there's a lot I can improve on. And that's kind of what I'm focused on. And that's where I'm looking. So
this episode is sponsored by Rag & Bone, makers of seriously good denim. I'm sure many of you will understand when I say that one of the worst wardrobe moments is when you finally have to retire a really good pair of jeans. You know the ones, they've been your go-to for years. They're perfectly broken in, ridiculously comfortable, but eventually they just get a bit too scruffy to keep wearing out in public. And you know you're going to have to go through the whole process again with a new pair. It's never quite the same, is it? Well, that's why I keep coming back to Rag & Bone's infused denim range, because they have that comfortable broken-in feel from the start. Stretch where you need it, structure where it matters, and they look great as well. It's all down to a mix of premium materials and an 8-step overdye process that gives the denim a rich, dimensional colour that actually gets better with time. And they come in a range of different fits, whether you prefer slim, straight, athletic, or relaxed, the Infused collection has something that works whatever your style. Rag & Bone have spent more than 20 years perfecting their denim, so these are built to last season after season, and they only get more comfortable the more you wear them. It's time to upgrade your denim with Rag & Bone. For a limited time, our listeners get 20% off their entire order with the code GRID at ragbone.com. That's 20% off at rag-bone.com with the promo code GRID. And when they ask you where you heard about them, please support F1B on the Grid and let them know we sent you. This episode is sponsored by CarGurus. Buying a car can sometimes feel like a bit of a guessing game. I remember the last time I was looking, comparing prices, mileage, different models, and wondering if I was actually looking at a good deal or not. But it really doesn't need to be that stressful. CarGurus is the only site in the UK that shows a deal rating on every car, from great to overpriced, so you can quickly see whether the price makes sense based on the vehicle's condition, mileage, and features. What's great is that it puts you firmly in the driver's seat with complete car specs, vehicle history, price change information, and dealer reviews. So you've got all the important details right there before you make a decision. And with hundreds of thousands of cars from top-rated dealers, it makes it much easier to compare options and find something that works for you. You can even set up real-time alerts for price drops and new listings so you never miss out. So join the millions who have already found their best deal with CarGurus. Go to cargurus.co.uk for complete vehicle details without any surprises. That's CarGurus, CarGurus.co.uk. CarGurus.co.uk. CarGurus. Search, buy, sorted. You say there's a lot to improve on. Something Colton Herter said on this podcast last week was that really when a by the time a driver's sort of 16, 17, assuming he's been karting from a young age, which he had and you have, he says he doesn't really think the speed gets any faster by the time you're 16, 17. You become a more intelligent racing driver in terms of how you read a race, but the speed doesn't improve. Do you agree with him?
Not really.
You think there's more speed to come?
Yeah. I think you can always improve. I think, obviously...
I think he was saying you can improve, but just the raw speed.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, obviously it's hard to compare sports, but in tennis you have a coach no matter what. Even Djokovic, when he's 37 or 36, is getting showed how to improve his forehand. I would say in racing it's the same. I think there's... In the end, we drive to the limit, which is our feeling. And if you can improve your feeling, then you go faster. So something I'm trying to do to improve, I mean, I think the sims are really good because they're not actually perfect. You know, in the sim, you don't feel what you feel in the real car, which means your stimulus for where you feel what's going on is different to the real car, which means if you can improve that, then you have more feeling in the car. I think it's really good when you drive different cars because then you start to get different feelings. If you were to drive a rally car, you start to get a very good feeling for the car in a different way. If you drive a road car, all these kind of things. These are kind of things that I'm looking to potentially explore with time.
In terms of feeling, the sim, it's all through the hands, right?
Yeah.
Whereas in the real car, it's more through your bum and your feet. Oh, well, all of it, right?
But it's mostly your bum, yeah.
Okay. Your gut. Is that right?
Your bum, so you your feel gut. It through your bum, but then your brain is like, it holds you back a little bit. It's like you have a horse and you're holding the reins. And every session you kind of release a little bit. And then it's sort of, for example, in Japan, in qualifying, you're always releasing a little bit, but it was only that last lap of Q2 where I just let go of the reins. And sometimes the horse is just going to go and it's like, can you hold on to it? And that's kind of, you know, when you just send it. I don't really know how we got onto this, to be honest. But I mean, Yeah, I don't know.
What about you and your competitiveness? Are you competitive in everything that you do? Not just at the racetrack?
I mean. Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, even in school. School is very important in my family. I come from Indian background on my mum's side, which is very known for the academics being important.
Was mum at Cambridge?
Mum was at Cambridge. My uncle was also at Cambridge. My mum's cousin was also at Cambridge. So I've come from quite an academic background. I think mum went to Trinity. I think it was Trinity. But anyway.
Oh, Harvard, you haven't gone to Cambridge.
I know. Unbelievable. My mum still gives me flack for that. Well, talking about mum, I think for her, when I told her at like 13, or maybe earlier, 11, you'd have to talk to her to know, but I think it was around 11, 12, I told her, I was like, mum, I'm not going to go to uni. She was like, what do you mean? What are you on about? It's like, mum, I'm going to be a Formula One driver. I'm not going to uni. She's like, well, let's see, kind of thing, you know. I was like, no, mum, I'm going to be in Formula One, so don't get your hopes up on uni. We'll find a way around the school, but that's plan B. But I don't really see that as.
And what plan B. Did mum say to you after Melbourne? Did she say, okay, I get it now?
No, I think that was the moment where she got it. I think for her that conversation was a bit of a. It sent a bit of shivers down her. She was very confused. She couldn't really. I think that was where she understood how. Driven I was, and this was what I was going to do, which I knew since I was five. This is what I was going to do. But that for her was when she realized that, I think she kind of appreciated the weight of it. So then from that moment, she's been on board and she's known this is what I'm working towards. So in Melbourne, she was just happy. She just gave me a hug and just said, well done. It was amazing, you know? And I think my parents have always been very supportive on that side because it's always been, as I've said, you know, so far, it's been my goal, my dream, you know, it's been my drive that's got me here. And my parents have been, you know, I'm here because of them, you know, because of the how hard they worked in their life to be able to have the opportunities to do this and their help through my sort of journey. But they've always just supported me and they've never really been any more than, you know, my dad's not one to really shout at me is what I'm trying to get at. You know, he was the one who was always just there for me, even if things didn't go well, because he knew that I was already annoyed at myself. So in all these kind of situations, my parents have always just been very supportive, very loving, which has always been nice.
So mum's side of the family, not motorsport fans.
No.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
So that influence came from the paternal side, from dad, your dad, Stefan.
Yeah. Yeah. So it actually more comes from my paternal grandfather, Farfar, as I call him, Swedish, which in Swedish, Far is dad, so dad's dad. Yeah, I mean, far forward, he loves motorsport. He'd watch anything with wheels and an engine. I mean, I remember when I was maybe like six or seven, my farmer and farfar, they don't have much money, to be honest, so they can't afford cable TV. So my dad has to, now he pays for them to have it, you know, but like, I mean, 15 years ago, no, it wasn't 15, anyway, whatever, 12 years ago, they didn't have it. So I remember coming down. My mum came down actually, and she told me afterwards, she came down to get some water at like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. My granddad was there scrolling through all the motorsport channels, watching them all, because he loves it. He just wanted to watch everything. So that's sort of where the passion started. So when he took my dad, they did it for about a year, they did motocross. They had to stop quite early, but they did motocross for about a year. So that sort of passion passed down to my dad. When I was three, my dad got me a motocross bike. So I started with motocross. It didn't last very long, only a couple months. I think it was a little bit too much for my mum to see a little kid that's, you know, learning to walk on a motocross bike.
Just to be clear, we're not talking mini moto, we're talking off-road, right?
Yeah, like in the mud, you know, like yeah, I wasn't yeah, quite going yeah. on jumps because I was three, but I mean like the traditional step would be to go like supercross, you know, that they do in the States.
Did you enjoy the freedom that you get on a bike? Walking up, I was
too young. Yeah, I don't really remember it that well. To be honest,
Do you get on a bike now?
No, I haven't really been on a bike since. We're actually talking today about potentially doing some stuff on it, but no, I haven't really been on one since. I don't know. I enjoyed it, but it wasn't that instant love, you know. I enjoyed it like any person does when they go to an amusement park, you know. But it wasn't like when I went karting for the first time. I didn't want to leave. You know, I was always about to be dragged out. And then immediately when I was in the cars asking him, when can we go again, when we can go again, you know, when I went karting for the first time, I loved it. So that really stuck a lot more.
And that was at Sandown in the UK. Is that right?
Yeah. I did a lot in Sandown. I think I went karting the first time somewhere else. It wasn't really karting. It was like basically like those toy bumper cars thing. But that was the first time I kind of sat in like a moving vehicle like that. But then I went to Sandown quite a few times because my dad knew that I had this sort of passion and I enjoyed it. But he, you know, obviously it's expensive. So he was just like, right, let's just do it for a couple months to see if you actually enjoy it and you're actually serious. So for about good 4 months, went to Sandown Park in Esher a lot. And then my dad bought me my first go-kart when I was 5, a few months later. We went a lot to Rye House, where Lewis started. We went to Bayford Meadows. Those are sort of two tracks I started at. But then where things really took off was when I was 7, we were moving house. And the house we were moving to wasn't quite ready yet. So we went to live with my grandparents for the summer. And they live in Bolton, near Manchester. And about 45 minutes away from there was a kart track called Hooton Park, which is very small. There's nothing really nice about it, to be honest. But that was where me and my dad would go every other day that summer. And I was driving all the time and absolutely loved it. And that was where things really took off. And I remember very well, my grandparents would come, you know, during the days they'd bring Indian food. You know, I remember having my nani's rajma and chapatis, you know, out the back of the car. So that was sort of the summer that really changed everything.
And that was the moment when you thought, I want to get to Formula One.
No, I'd say that happened already when I was...
That had already happened.
Yeah, yeah.
That's extraordinary clarity of thought, isn't it?
For me, the moment where the seed sort of was sown was when I was 4. My dad was sitting on the sofa at home and he had the F1 on and I came and sat next to him and I was watching the cars and I was in awe, you know. I was sitting there for a couple of minutes just looking at all these cars go past. This would have been, what, 2011? So, you know, I've got Seb, Jensen, Lewis. I'm watching this race and I'm just like, wow, this is so cool. This is crazy. And I remember asking my dad, like, could I ever be there one day? Like, how does this work? Like, is it possible? You know, and I started badgering him with these questions. And that was where I was really like, this is nuts. I want to do it. And then a year later, we went to Silverstone. It was, what, 2013 Grand Prix? So it must have been end of 11 or maybe beginning of 2012. But yeah, a year later, went to 2013 British Grand Prix. And that was the moment where I really knew. Sort of the sofa was when the seed sort of came. But then when I went to the F1 race the first time, I knew I wanted to do it and I wanted to be in Formula One.
And did that change your attitude to how you went karting?
Yes, but I would say that it was so early on that it didn't really feel like it changed. It was kind of just like, it was still kind of in the beginning. You know, it wasn't like it was halfway through. So then all of a sudden I was like, right, now I'm going to start. You know, it was really so early on that I don't really remember from before this moment. So all I remember is every time I went to the kart track, I had the goal of getting to Formula One. It was never a hobby for me. It was always, you know, maybe my dad will say it was, but for me, it was never a hobby. Every time I went to the track, I was having fun, but I was also thinking, you know, how can I be better? How can I learn? How can I improve? And a lot of that also did come from my dad. It's a big part of thanks to him that in the beginning, he was never focused on the equipment. You know, a lot of, you know, kids and their parents, they were trying to get the best engines, the best chassis, the best team. And I had quite lousy equipment, but my dad spent the money on driver coaches. All the time I'd have driver coaches, you know, work on how can I get better. I do remember having a conversation with him at one point. You know, I was like, Dad, you know, this is so difficult. Running around in like P10, you know, I've got no power. Like, I'm not having fun here. You know, why can't you just get me a better engine? And he's like, no, you can, when you're ready, you'll get a better engine, but you're not ready yet. You know, you've still got a lot you can improve on. So it was always about driver coaches.
And that's when Oliver Rowland came into your life, right?
That leads into Ollie. So I was driving for a team called Zip, which had a relationship with RSF, which Ollie was a part of, Racing Steps Foundation. And my dad asked the team, he was just like, you know, if any of the drivers have a weekend off and they want a bit of extra pocket money, you know, it'd mean the world to us if they could come and just do a day with Arvid. And Ollie was sort of scrambling for anything he could get. So he was, you know, immediately up for it. And I remember meeting Ollie when I was 7. And every 6 months we do a test day. And he'd help out.
Oh, but how would he help out? Would he be telling you where to brake? Would he be with setup, that kind of thing?
No, it was driving, not so much a setup. It was everything on driving. It was talking about lines. It was, you know, brake here, you need to turn this way. You need to feel the car in this way. And it was really just like, it was obviously very basic, but it was really just, it was all about driving. Because he was so good at the driving, he, you know, he really helped me. I loved working with Ollie. So every time he could come, you know, I'd ask for it. And we had a very close relationship because of that. So I remember at the end of 2016, at the end of my first year, we're in a bit of a difficult first year of like racing properly. It's like national, doing British Championship and stuff. It was a bit difficult with the teams because we'd moved team to something called to a place called AIM that was going really well. But then the boss, he wanted to stop with the team. We didn't really know where to go because there was another team called Fusion. We didn't really want to go there because it was a big team. And my dad wanted me to be in a small team. He didn't mind if it was worse, but he wanted me to be in a small team because then I get more attention that helps me to learn and improve. So we didn't really know where to go. And so my dad asked Ollie to come to a race. So Ollie came in maybe January 2017, one of the first races. And he was saying, right, I'm going to start a team with Arvid. You know, this isn't working. Let's, you know, I think what he told me actually was that plan A was you go to Fusion. Plan B was you stay in Zip, or plan C is I could start a karting team with Arvid. And my dad immediately was like, yeah, let's do that. Let's start a team.
Do plan C.
Yeah, plan C, let's start a team. That sounds great. So, and I think Ollie kind of said that more out of a, yeah, you know, maybe we could do this. I don't think he'd really thought it through. But then it was happening before we know. We had a sprinter van, we had a little pop-up tent, and it was me, Ollie, my mechanic, Alex, going all around the UK. And we were learning stuff together. I mean, for Ollie, he was racing F2 at the time, which is pretty nuts. You know, he was racing with Charles that year, 2017. And we're going all over the UK. And that was where things really took off. I finished second that year to Taylor Barnard, who's now racing in Formula E. Then the year after, I won the British Championship. And yeah, then I went to race in Europe at 11. And obviously, Ollie couldn't continue the team in Europe, but we'd stay very much in contact. At the end of every day, you know, I'd send him a voice note, we'd have a call about how things were going. He'd come to a few of the races in Europe. Then it was similar in F4. He came to a few of the races, a few of the tests. And then it was beginning of F3, so between F4 and F3, where he really stepped up, because it's very rare for people to do the step from F4 to F3 because it is such a big step. Just to put it in lap time terms, between F4 and F3 is the same as F3 and F1. Is about 13 seconds, 14 seconds. So almost no one does that step. And the people that do that step, almost none of them have been able to perform the first year. And it was what...
And we know what happened, right?
Well, this
was
what...
You win your first race.
Well, yeah. This is what, you know, it was... This was, you know, Helmut, we had the vision and this was, you know, what we were doing. So we had to put a lot of effort in. I remember I was pretty nervous at the start of that year and I needed all the help I can get. So Ollie became a lot more involved and he started coming to a lot of the races. I think he came to 6 or 7 of the races in that year. And yeah, it went pretty well. I won my first race in Bahrain. A few rounds later, I won the feature race in Barcelona. And then I had the double win in Silverstone. And yeah.
First time that had happened, yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty nuts. I mean, it was a very special year. I think I broke a few records. And I think that was, yeah, the year that I think change things, because yes, last year in F2 was good, but there was a lot of ups and downs. But I would say the year in F3 really helped me to be here.
Change things from a Red Bull perspective in terms of how they looked at you. Is that what you mean?
I mean, I always had a very close relationship with Helmut, and I think there was always the vision that we had together. But I would say maybe it helped consolidate things. And gave me maybe a bit more of a buffer when things were a bit more difficult in F2.
Okay. We've talked about some of the key people. You know, Dad was clearly one. Oliver Rowland was clearly one. Can we talk a little bit about Helmut? He can be quite harsh on young drivers. How was your relationship with him?
He can be. And there is a lot of stories, obviously, about Helmut. But my relationship with Helmut was very special. And a lot of these stories I can't really relate to. We met for the first time in Portimao when I was 13. And I remember I was just very excited to meet, you know, the guy that had brought Max to F1, that had brought Sebastian, you know, all these amazing guys that had gone on to do great things. And I was obviously very proud that he'd wanted to give me that same opportunity. But yeah, our relationship was very good. We were very honest with one another. You know, we said things how it was, and that helped me to learn and to improve. There was never any rubbish. Like I said, it was always very honest, and it was a lot thanks to his guidance and expertise. Also, thanks to Rocky as well, that I was able to come through the ranks so quickly to be here today. And
Rocky as in Sebastian Vettel's ex race engineer.
Yes, so I think it's Guillaume Roquelin. Is his name. But everyone calls him Rocky now. Yeah. He joined the program in 2022. I joined end of 2020, but I was in karting at the time, so I wasn't that heavily really involved in the program. But then as soon as I stepped up to cars, he was obviously there. So they were both a big thanks to why I've been able to come through the ranks so quickly. And yeah, I don't know, like I said with Helmut, we always got along very well. We said things how it was, and he helped me to learn. And there's a lot of stories about him being difficult and, you know, not the easiest to work with. But for me, he was always amazing. And he's a big thanks to why I'm here today. He always had my back and he always believed in me. And even when things were going difficult last year, he was the one who believed in me most and has helped for me to have this opportunity this year. So I'll always be grateful to him for that.
Even though Helmut's not traveling this year, have you stayed in touch? I imagine he's very proud of you and how it started.
Yeah, we stay in touch. We called after Australia and he's still following along. He's trying to stay a bit more sort of in the shadows and, you know, a bit more away from it. But he still knows everything that's happening. And I'm sure that he'll be at a race this year. Yeah, obviously I'm sad that he's no longer in the paddock because we did get along really well. But I think the way I try to look at it is that I think it's really impressive that someone of his age was going to 24 races a year, showing his passion, dedication, love for the sport at his age.
I'm trying to imagine what he said to you after Melbourne. Ah, Ovid, not bad, or something like that. I can imagine him saying something like that. Not bad, well done.
he was like, so Ovid, everyone in Red Bull is now a Lindblad fan. That was what his words were. So, that was pretty cool.
Ovid, I think after this chat, a lot of people listening to this will be Lindblad fans as well. Look, thank you so much for your time. It's been great to get to know you a little bit. Look, final one for me really is the season kick starts in Miami this coming weekend. Look, what does success look like for you over the remainder of 26? What are your goals?
Honestly, even though the first few races have gone well, I'm still going to try to keep with that same mentality of just focusing on myself and doing as best as I can. So I wouldn't say I've got too many outcome goals. I mean, obviously, I want to do well. Me and Liam have been, you know, fighting hard the first couple of races. So I want to, you know, continue to be right up there with him and, you know, obviously try to beat him. But in the end, that is an outcome thing. You know, that's an output. So that's what I'd like to achieve. But to make that happen, I need to focus on myself and make sure I'm doing everything right on my side, all the procedures, all that sort of stuff. So that's where I'm going to put the effort. For especially these next few races, but I think for the rest of the year, and then we'll see what happens.
Well, very good luck with it all. Thank you very much.
Cheers. Thank you for your time.
What an incredible conversation. I had to keep reminding myself that Arvid is only 18 years old because he's already so articulate and confident. His story so far is both unique and inspiring. But let's remember, this is only the beginning of the beginning for him. Arvid, thank you very much for your time and good luck this coming weekend in Miami and for the remainder of the season. And as you said, keep focusing on yourself and I'm sure everything will pan out just fine. Now, on the subject of Miami, Jolyon Palmer, James Hinchcliffe and I look forward to the race on this week's episode of F1 Nation. That's out now. Thanks very much for listening, and I will, of course, be back next week with another great guest from the world of Formula One. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audioboom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.
May is Maytag month, and Menards is passing the savings on to you. You need reliable and energy-efficient appliances to conquer the day. Menards is your one-stop shop with appliances in stock and ready to take home today. Check out our top appliance brands, including KitchenAid, Maytag, Whirlpool, Amana, and Criterion. Save big money on Maytag appliances at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money.